Welcome to Discovery 2, Module 3, Planning a Network Upgrade. Okay, now before I start on Discovery 2, Module 3, has anybody even read this chapter?
I have.
So have I. That's okay. That's alright. Okay, that's just checking. Just checking. Which means it'll all be new and exciting and enjoyable for you all. Woohoo! Okay. Discovery 2, Module 3. I have to calm down. I've only even had one coffee this morning. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Now, yes, poor old Alex has been unwell, so we welcome him back from his yearly bout of allergy, which is a seasonal flu, which just means they don't know what it is, but he sort of just went wibble, and they give him water, drugs and stuff, which is good. Okay. Yes. Now, planning a network upgrade. Many companies upgrade their networks piecemeal and find that the network all falls to bits. Can anybody tell me what is the first very important thing that you have to do before you undertake a project that nobody ever does because they can never be bothered until it all blows up in their face?
Back up.
Planning.
There's a thought. I don't know whether you remember sort of wandering around with those kids that had this really great idea that they made up as they went along, and by the end of the day you just wanted to not associate with this particular kid because their great ideas had got you into all sorts of trouble because nobody had actually planned anything. And you'd think people would learn from those sorts of experiences, but no. Some people have this habit of when the network, you know, we need to hook on another computer. Well, I didn't know Cheryl was coming in this week and Cheryl needs a computer, so what we'll do is we'll get this really cheap switch that I picked up from insert name of popular electronics chain on my way to work, and then we'll just wire it into that spare port there, which should be fine, and then wire Cheryl into that particular hub and it should be all good. Okay, but what happens is you end up upgrading the network with all different sorts of vendors' equipment, and it's not until 3 months later that you discover that brand A switch doesn't work with brand B switch when you've got a brand C patch cable. And this sort of stuff can cause you all sorts of downtime, unhappiness. Also, the networks that are upgraded like that don't tend to be very well documented. And I've actually experienced this. You go into an organisation to do some contract work and you go, so, how's this network laid out? And there's a horrible silence. A bit like when I say things like, has anybody read this chapter? It's the same sort of silence. And they don't know. And they're not sure. And there's a couple of people who think they know. But they're not sure either. But the bloke that did know got another contract 3 months ago and he's gone. So obviously your first step in planning a network upgrade is a site survey. And that's site as in the site of where they're located, not as in looking at stuff. So yes, you blind people can do site surveys too. Different site. Which makes you wonder whether you should come up with something called second sight networking or something. Now, you can actually go and you actually map out what the network is. How many hubs have they got? How many switches have they got? How is their internet connection set up? How is everything wired in? What addresses have everything got on them? And you sit down and you document it all. And you, if you have some vision, you set up the network diagram, and you draw it all out. Otherwise, if you can't see, you document it all in a meaningful way. Well, at least that's the theory.
And it's very important. Or you can try and use a tactile mapper.
Yeah, but how many blind people do you know that have got a PF in their basement?
No, like the APH tactile mapping kit. That's like $30.
Yeah. I don't think you get them over here, generally speaking.
Oh, okay, I wouldn't do it. I'd be terrible at it anyway, but just a thought.
Look, I'm sure those people who could do that, that would be quite useful, but one of the problems with the tactile mapping kit is actually putting the labels on. You could probably draw the symbols, but you wouldn't have room to necessarily write the labels, and you'd probably have to come up with a key or something. So, also, I think it'd be fair to say that a lot of blind people don't have particularly good spatial skills, so the floor plan might look a bit interesting. Okay, but the theory is that you have to draw up this floor plan, or in theory you should be able to get your hands on a floor plan, although in my experience nobody's got one, or you draw up the floor plan, and for example, one of the applications that's often used to do simple network diagrams, which I don't know how accessible it is, I haven't tried, is a thing called Visio. And you can put all sorts of information on the particular icons and stuff and draw up the workstations and that sort of thing. Now, it's important that you... So the reason you might look at planning a network upgrade is because you're looking at the network not being able to support the number of users and the amount of traffic that is travelling over the network. And often you start off with a small network and it gets bigger and the business sort of expands and you just sort of add things on and things just don't go particularly well. The other thing you're also looking at with a site survey is what have we got and where can we put new stuff? Okay, case in point, they've gone and organised all this building that we're in at the moment, and nobody really knows where the X-Serve's going to go because they really don't know how much space they've got and they're not sure what is in there. And I think if we went and asked them for a network diagram, they'd probably throw me down the lift shaft. So we're not going to do that. We're not sure really what's wired up and how it was wired up, and the bloke who wired it up is gone, and nobody's really sure of how the VLANing's done on the switches, and it's all good, okay? So this can cause you somewhat of a challenge if you're actually doing these sorts of jobs to find out what is there, how it is all set up, and stuff. Sometimes people get upset because you charge them for that too, but it is a service you charge for, and it's part of the project cost. You actually get paid for documenting their existing network. And of course the understanding is that you provide them with the network documentation and stuff so that they can keep it on file for future consultants. So, you're investigating the number of users and the types of equipment they're using. The projected growth, how many more employees are we planning for? And what sort of margin do we want to do that for, based on what budget we've got for the expansion? What is the current internet connectivity? Are you even connected to your wireless network, or have you been nicking somebody else's bandwidth for the past 6 months without knowing it? Yes, it's happened. It's also highly illegal. And I would be tracking people's IP addresses and knocking on their door and then reporting them to authorities, but then again, I'm a nasty person. Application requirements. What are these people going to run on this network? Are we playing World of Warcraft? Are we running Microsoft Word? Are we all going to surf the internet? All of those sorts of important questions that you need to know as far as the business is concerned. What sort of network connectivity do you require? That sort of thing. Actually, interestingly enough, just as an aside, there's a good reason why people ban Facebook at work. One, it's a complete waste of time. But it is a social networking site. But secondly, it is very bandwidth intensive. And if you're watching videos on Slide FunSpace, you might be using up network bandwidth that somebody else might need to listen to the cricket. I mean, to do their tax returns. The other problem, of course, is you actually see people. A lot of people in Australia, our bandwidth is metered, so it's you get a certain number of megs or a certain number of gigabytes. And what often happens is people log on to internet radio stations and listen to internet radio stations, not realising that for each minute of internet radio they're listening to, they're chewing up bandwidth. And it's all well and good if one or two people do it generally, but if 10 people all log on from their cubicles listening to whatever radio station they want, you can run out of available bandwidth very quickly. And in those particular situations, you may actually want to look at putting the people who listen to the same radio stations close to each other and getting them a radio. It'd be easier. Okay, so you're looking at what new services they want, and you're looking at the existing physical layout of the existing network. And there's a note that says you've basically got to watch out when you're doing these site surveys, because you don't know, there's no guarantee that they have adhered to all quality standards. You're probably going to end up with people with cables stretched across the floor with this nice mat put over the top of them so that all of your cabling sins are hidden until person number 304 steps on it and breaks one of the cables. You might have things run along walls and cables stretched across the ground. And I remember seeing the server room at the TAFE that I worked at. It all seemed to be quite nicely set up, but it wasn't until you actually looked at how all of the nested power boards were laid out that you discovered that there was a cable that ran to one power point. And that switch was quite accessible, so if you flipped the switch on the one power point, you could take the entire server room down. I remember, with my finger poised above this switch, asking the network administrator whether there were any interruptible power supplies. I was requested to remove my hand from said switch, and that no, there weren't currently any uninterruptible power supplies, and that was something we'd be working on when some funding came through. This was quite a number of years ago. Now, has anybody got any questions about any of that so far? It's not particularly rocket science, but any questions, comments, things that people would like to add?
We had a school for the blind which was gigantic, and nobody knew the network configuration because our IT guy was not the brightest, and it became a really big problem because somebody had set up automatic updates on our network. And one day there was an automatic update that was bad, and he had to trace every computer and figure out how to fix it on every computer, and it was just ridiculous.
Oh dear, it would have been very popular.
Yeah, and has anybody actually seen, it happens about every month or three, Windows Genuine Advantage fails for legitimate customers, and you get a whole stack of legitimate like corporate licenses that fail to validate, and it causes a lot of consternation and unhappiness because all of these PCs that have got legitimate purchase information and proper Windows keys and everything's actually fail Windows Genuine Advantage, and the users have got balloons in their task trays going, you know, your Windows may be illegitimate. Okay, the other things you've got to look at is security and privacy expectations. Just a very simple example of that, you probably don't want an open wireless network, given the amount of people who believe that stealing other people's bandwidth is okay and it's kind of cool. Look, I'm a bit passionate about that. So basically, you want to look at security and privacy concerns, make sure you've got, if you are running wireless networking equipment, the wireless networks are secured, make sure that the keys are only given to the people who need them, and make sure that, but also make sure for security as far as servers and stuff. You don't want the servers out on the desk in the training room, company. Theoretically, a student could walk up and rip the power out of our server, and that would take us offline. That wouldn't be very cool. Occasionally, there have been people known to turn off the wrong PowerPoint, and that will take a switch load of five computers down. A number of people have done it. It's not just one person. There's been about three or four who've flipped off PowerPoints without actually checking what's plugged into them. And they're the sort of things in a business that you don't want happening. you sort of want to know what's going what, and you want to keep the infrastructure and stuff away from the general employees. You don't want the cleaner unplugging the server to plug in her vacuum cleaner. Because whilst the vacuum cleaner or his vacuum cleaner, let's be equal opportunity here. While the vacuuming is important, so is having the web server up, for example. And there are cases where servers have had the power ripped out of them because the cleaner wants to plug the vacuum cleaner in. That power cord doesn't look like it goes anywhere. We'll pull that one. So it's important that you know what all the power cords are. It's important, if possible, that you label them. And there are labels with sticky tag with tags on them you could stick Dymo to. We got some. I can't remember where they went, but we got some. They'll be around somewhere. And the other one you could probably do is labels with barcodes on them. And that was the way I looked at doing it, was with the IDMate talking barcode scanner. So you could just swipe across a cable and it would tell you what that cable was. You've got to look at budget constraints. How much do these people want to spend on this upgrade? Or more specifically, how much can you convince them to spend on this upgrade given what they can actually afford? There's no point suggesting that we upgrade all of our computers to, like, you know, Cray's and stuff, because we're never going to get the funding for it at the moment. Although if we, you know, get the funding, we probably could do that. So you've really got to look at, like, if you're looking at a non-profit organisation, you might actually seriously suggest that they look at running Linux file servers, or perhaps you might want to put an Apple server in, perhaps, rather than running Microsoft stuff, because the non-profit might not be able to afford the licenses. Keep in mind that I think a 10-user license for Windows Server 2008 is something around the $5,000 mark. Somebody can Google up a price for that at some point while I'm going on about this, and we'll find out what it is. I can't exactly remember, but it should be easy enough to find out. But so this stuff is not cheap, and you've got to have enough client access licenses for the number of clients you've got and stuff, so it can actually be quite expensive to license this stuff, which is why...
Which software do you want to know a site license for?
Windows Server 2008. Or any of the Windows Server operating systems, Windows Server 2003, Windows Server 2008, whichever you like. It's quite expensive, and you've got to basically put the budget aside for it and stuff. We have a case here, for example, where they don't have the funding for another copy of Microsoft Exchange so that the training center can have their own little pretend email server. I set up a Linux one, but they want all the calendaring and stuff, so we probably could do that under Linux, but money hasn't been shoved my way, so it hasn't happened. Okay, try not to offend the customer by talking about the network. So you're not going to walk in the first day, see these cables you know, stretched across the floor and go, "Oh, I can't believe you guys even ran this business on this crud." I mean, that is really not cool, okay? Don't say that. You've got to be as positive and forward-thinking as you can be with the network upgrade, and possibly tell them how good their new network is going to be without actually comparing it to their old network. Because there are some pretty shocking network setups out there. Often telling somebody how bad their network is isn't very productive, given the fact that they're basically looking at improving it, and often people did the best they could with the resources they had at the time. So that's probably worth considering. Not everybody has the resources for top-notch tech. So going into somebody's house and just going, "Oh, Don't tell me you've still got B wireless. Huh, that is so 1997. That's probably not cool. So, yeah. It is also possible that some of this infrastructure is doing what they want it. Okay, so yeah, don't run the old networking equipment down. Careful of safety concerns, you don't know who wired what up. I remember seeing a setup where the way to turn on the air conditioning unit was to grab the power cable, which didn't actually have a plug on it, and then poke the wires into the power point until the air conditioner came on. Yeah, this was a bit disturbing. The other fact that there was actually some wires that were about 3 inches from your hand that were actually exposed live and 240 volts also wasn't particularly cool. So perhaps the safety concerns in that particular place were quite big ones, and they should really do something about it. There is no excuse for poor safety stuff. You really don't want... Okay. Let's see. Actually, there is clear process. I know where you can get it from. Look under software. Okay, now. Let's see. So, yeah, be careful what they've got, and you don't know what sort of nasty things that the people, the contractors, or the shortcuts that the contractors and things took previously. You have to interview the customer. That's very important. You've got to talk to the customer and make sure that they know what you, you know, that your their expectations and your expectations are within, you know, reality and all that sort of good stuff. Also investigate what equipment might be missing. What don't they have? It's important to be making notes during this thing. And writing down the things that occur to you and stuff so that you can look at it and come back and sort those sorts of things out. Now, there are two sorts of topology. There is the physical topology, which is the way that everything is laid out. You basically look at how everything's laid out and you draw a picture and you label the picture, or you describe how things are hooked up. And in fact, I think as an assignment, and I will be posting this to Cavi Announce later, I would like all students to document their home network for me. How is it physically laid out, and how is it logically laid out? Who just dropped off? Oh, that's all right then. Yeah, that's fine. Okay. Lucky this is a noise-cancelling microphone. Not that I'm inferring that Kieran makes noise here, I'm just making the point. Yes, now I've just derailed my train of thought. Yes, I'm going to make all of you students document your home network. What have you got? Where is it? How is it all connected? That's the physical topology. And the logical topology is IP addresses and computer names and what's connected to what. What routers have you got and how are they cabled together? I know, you're all now saying it's not fair and we don't like him anymore. But do you guys even have this documentation for your network? Like, has anybody actually sat down and done this?
No, I just kind of know what mine is, so I probably should.
Well, actually, you definitely should, because you're about to leave that house, and it's going to make it very difficult for anybody to fix that network in your absence, interestingly enough.
This is very true, but nobody really could fix the network in my absence.
But if something breaks and they have to pay somebody to fix it, your network documentation could save them quite a lot of money so that they won't need to spend 2 hours working out what was there before they actually fix it. So I'm just sort of trying to sweeten up this assignment that you're going to have to do. So, yeah, that's okay. It would be a good idea to document your network. What have you got? What's there? What's your physical topology? What's your logical topology? When you're doing wireless networks, the physical topology of the wireless network is basically its coverage area. And as we know, wireless has very limited range, especially given double brick walls and those sorts of things. So you need to figure out what sort of area you'd like to cover with wireless, if that's something you're putting in, and how many wireless access points you're going to put in to cover that area. Interestingly enough, we had a situation about a month or two ago, which has now been resolved, where you couldn't get internet access here at the theatrette because none of the wireless access points would reach the theatrette. Actually, ours would, but it was Mac locked. So they ended up having to look at putting another wireless access point in so that it could cover that particular area. One of the problems I personally perceive is you can't get wireless internet access in the cafe. That would be kind of cool because our wireless network doesn't quite get down the hall. Although there are various managerial reasons why we can't fix that. Now, talking about different network layouts, you've got... Has anybody got any questions so far before I go on to network layouts?
No.
And, by the way, regarding this assignment, it's not hugely long. You probably only need a page or so of what you've actually got and how it's hooked up. We don't want an essay. We just want, you know, this is hooked to that, and that's hooked to that, and that's hooked to that, and whatever. And perhaps the reasons why. So, for example, upstairs bedrooms require internet access. Therefore, wireless connection from blah to blah. All that sort of good stuff. Do we still have our two Indians with us? Are you guys still with us? We haven't heard anything from you guys, that's all.
Yes, sir, we are here.
Okay, no worries. Just checking that you guys were still there and stuff, and it's all good.
Okay, so I have a price on one Windows Server license.
Mm-hmm, yep.
That's going to run you about $950.
Okay, how many? Does it say how many cals?
I think it's one. You can buy another 5-pack down below for like $139.
Ah, righto, so there you go. Okay, so that's $950 for the initial server license and then $139 for 5 cals to go on top of that. So that'll set you back $1,000. Bit over. That's why I run Linux at home, it's cheaper. Okay. You can actually buy an Apple server license for $600 or $700. Are there connection limits on Apple server? You can either get a 10-user version, or you can get an unlimited license, and they tell me there's about $100 difference in the price. It's not a lot. Yeah, $500, $699 or something. I mean, So it's not that expensive. I mean, basically, they've got a whole lot of GNU stuff running their operating system, so they probably don't feel that they want to charge people too much, but it is a nice operating system, and they've got their server stuff in there, and it's an option for a lot of people if you want that sort of thing. Okay, so you've got your bus topology, which is where, as I said, you've got the terminators at each end, and you've got a big run of coax or whatever, and all of the computers are connected onto the bus. You've got the star topology, which is where you have the switches in the middle, or the hubs in the middle, and all of the computers going out from each on all different angles, in basically the shape of a star. You have an extended star, which is where you have multiple stars connected together, basically by the one of the points of the star. So, for example, you've got switches daisy chained together, or hubs daisy chained together. Although, if you've still got hubs in 2009 and you're not doing network diagnostic stuff, maybe it's time to consider a network upgrade because switches are pretty useful. There probably would be certain specialised applications for hubs, but generally speaking, there's not a lot of hubs around. I mean, to give you some idea, I got given a Belkin 5-port switch a couple of months ago because the people didn't have any use for it, and it was just taking up space, and they wanted to get rid of the switch. So, pretty much a commodity. Although I remember I think I paid $143 for my 5-port gigabit D-Link switches back in 1999, and that was a bargain. Okay, they've got this nifty little acronym thing called SWOT, which is Strengths, Weaknesses, Opportunities, and Threats. Okay, that's good. Okay, let's move on. Requirements analyses. What do they want? What do they need to have happen? What priorities are these things? And how much of these things do they actually need for the business? And are they planning for future growth? There's not really a huge amount of point upgrading the network so that it will just deal with what's on the network. You want to plan for a little bit more capacity than what is currently there so that you don't have to do a network upgrade constantly, given that, you know, you didn't upgrade it very much the last time. All team members analyze the network. So you're assuming that you're working with a team here. You create prototypes, which are test versions of bits of networking equipment and stuff to make sure that it's going to function as you expect it to function. This can be especially important if you're looking at things like firewalls or internet connectivity devices or whatever. You may need to ascertain that the device behaves under the expected load. It is a well-known phenomenon that if you try and put a small business on the internet through a small home router, you can often overload the connection table and stuff, and the router won't have the necessary features to be able to handle that sort of connection load. As we have here, yes. Good point. I'm still waiting for a message back from that fellow at Cisco, and we'll have a better router in real soon now, TM. But yes, our small office, home office router does occasionally crash in the middle of lecture. When the design is approved by the team and the client, your implementation can start. And the implementation plan needs to leave a certain amount of time for things to go wrong. You don't want things to go wrong. But inevitably things will go wrong from time to time, or you didn't necessarily think of something. Now, this is probably bad planning, and project managers would be jumping up and down and saying, well, this is not the way you should do it. You should always plan for these sorts of things. A little bit of forward planning can save you a lot of headaches and stuff. I knew of a particular organization that basically had a new building, and they had planned everything out, and they'd run all the cables in the walls and everything, and they didn't have any switches. This did put their network plan back a little bit. Luckily it was resolved and everybody's happy. But it does pay to actually plan out what you're going to do and know where you're headed and know what you need and what time frames you expect things to happen in. Okay, and if you've got time for things to go wrong, you can then have some time to fix that. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Star Trek, where Star Trek the original series, some would argue the only real Star Trek, where Scotty always tells the captain that it's going to take longer to fix the warp drive than it actually will, so that when he does fix the warp drive, he looks really good. We don't suggest you do that in IT, because if anybody ever catches you out, you'll be in a lot of trouble. But it is interesting that, you know, he leaves times for things to go wrong. When you're documenting the logical topology of the network, you need to note down the layer 3 addresses, which are things like your IP addresses for various equipment.
Now, phase 4 is a production setup.
Oh, and phase 5 is the review. Is the review and implementation. Make sure the user experience meets the goals. Are the people happy with this network upgrade you put in? Are the users actually having perceived improvement in their network performance? Are things happening faster? Are things more reliable? All of those sorts of good things. There's no better way to disillusion users than to break all of the computing infrastructure that they're used to and then have all sorts of things not work after the network upgrade. They tend to hunt down the IT guy. And that's not a lot. Any questions so far?
Not yet.
Oh, that sounds promising. We might actually have a question today. Maybe later.
It's more of a question about the assignment, but it's a me question since I have two networks, so, yeah.
Well, no, you don't have two networks. You only have one network. You just happen to have an extra wireless network configured on that network.
That's what I mean. I've got two extra wireless, or I have two wireless networks. I don't believe that they both feed into each other. I mean, it's only one internet connection, but I think they're on two separate access points, so they don't share.
They do share because it's all connected to the same wired infrastructure. If you connect to either of those wireless networks, you'll still get internet access. Therefore, they're connected.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's interesting. So, it means that you have access to two wireless network segments. You can either connect to the 5.8 gig stuff or you can connect to the 2.4 gig stuff, but they both share the AT&T cable connection. So, yes, they do exist on the one network and should be documented as part of the overall network.
Okay. They're just different logically.
No, because they still pull... they still pull addresses from the same DHCP server. So we'll talk about that outside of lecture. But yeah, essentially it's two different bands that you can connect to the wireless access points on, but you are connecting to the same wired distribution service. You're pulling IP addresses from the same DHCP servers. You're getting the same level of internet connectivity as a result of that. So... I think I've got, two wireless access points at home, Drongo and Shonky, and we also had Mango at one point. That was the third access point we had, and they actually run on different channels, and they've got different encryption keys, and depending on which one you're talking, which one you're connecting to. You set up different settings and stuff, but it still gives access to the same underlying infrastructure.
Oh, it's always cool.
Yeah.
So it's more about the actual internet connection you have as to which network you're on. It's not about the access point.
No. Well, I mean, if it's all wired into the same internet, if it's all wired into the same overall cable structure, which we call the wired distribution system. If it's all wired into the same cable structure, and then that's all connected into your internet connection, it's all part of the one network. The fact that you've got six access points on four different channels with eight different encryption keys only means that different people can connect to different access points given the different keys and given the different locations. It's still giving you access to the same underlying infrastructure.
Oh, okay, cool, gotcha.
Okay, now, you have to make sure the costs meet the design goals. Everybody gets unhappy when you go over budget, and basically what happens is people have to figure out where the money's coming from, if indeed they have money, and then if they run out of money, there's a possibility that you don't get paid, and that's not very cool either. Monitor and record changes. Document, 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 document. Make sure that you've got everything documented. The MDF is the main distribution frame, and it's basically the wiring closet that everything comes out of, and all the central wiring and stuff comes out of there. You want to do a cabling plan, and make sure that the cabling plan is up to spec, and that it... it adheres to the TIA/EIA standards, which is the Telecommunication Industry Association and the Electrical Industry Association, standards and stuff for how to run cables, where to run them, how far away from interference to keep them, all of those sorts of good things. You usually have a patch panel, usually have a patch from the wall to the workstation, if you're doing it properly, and that is called horizontal cabling. You also have the horizontal cable from the workstation to the IDF, which is the intermediate distribution frame. That's horizontal cabling. So, if you're looking at large areas, you often have a patch panel for, say, a particular room, or a patch panel for a particular floor, and everything patches into that patch panel. Because remember, you do have 100 meters limitation on the length of the cabling from whatever switch and stuff you're using to the workstations. So you do have to keep that in mind. And then the vertical cabling runs from the IDF to the MDF, which is the intermediate distribution frame, to the main distribution frame. Backbone cable handles main traffic. That's pretty self-explanatory. Note the location of the wiring closets, and can you get into them? You probably will need to get into them, so you need to coordinate with the people that have got the keys and stuff to those wiring closets to be able to work on them. Customers can either buy equipment outright, or they can lease it from the internet service provider. That depends on the customer's needs, how much money they've got, whether they can afford to buy the equipment outright, or whether they would choose to pay it off over a prolonged period of time. Make sure that when you're picking equipment that you check the capabilities of the equipment. The switches, can they be managed, or are they just fairly dumb switches? The cost of them, and also the complexity of them. What sort of complexity do you need, and are there going to be people in the company or people contracted that are going to be able to manage those switches? Some switches have a fixed configuration. In other words, you have 8 ports, you have 16 ports, you have 48 ports. Some of them are modular. You can actually add more ports. You can add another card with 8 ports or 16 ports or whatever. Some companies go, if they're going to expect a lot more growth, they will tend to go for modular configuration of the switches. If you are selecting routers, make sure they have the correct connections for the equipment that they are going to connect to. There is no point having a cable modem if your connection to the internet is ADSL. Don't laugh, it's happened. You really need to make sure you know what you're dealing with and that you order the correct routers and things. And in fact, I think Cisco has given students who are studying with them access to a brief Cisco product guide. I remember an email coming out a month or two ago about that. And that guide is actually quite useful because it tells you what models of Cisco are out there, what's connected to them, and what sort of things they can connect into, and suggested usage scenarios, which can be very useful if you're planning somebody else's network. Yes.
Yes, they give access to all of them, past and present. The thing is that you can't pre-order them. If you pre-order them or want them in paper format, then you have to pay. But you do not have to pay if you want them, and you'll wait a couple months to get them.
Yes, and that's good for us, because even though they're a couple of months out of date, unless you're actually working in the industry, and if you're working in the industry, the understanding is you would afford to pay for them, perhaps. Okay, make sure the router has the features you want, such as security, quality of service, which is making sure that no particular application eats up all of your internet bandwidth. Virtual private networking. Are you interested in setting up VPNs between distant offices, and do you want the router to do that, or are you going to look at another VPN solution? Voice over IP. And if you're having voice over IP, are you going to prioritize that traffic? How are you going to prioritize that traffic? And how are you going to make sure that you maintain core quality, especially under high network load? DHCP, NAT. So lots of a network address translation. So how many IP addresses do you have externally speaking, and how are you going to share those IP addresses out? How many logical subnets are you going to have inside the network? Are you going to separate people from each other by putting them on separate subnets? And can your router handle NATing more than one subnet? Some can, some can't. Okay, they want us to talk about the Cisco 1841, which is an integrated service router, which basically has a switch. It's got VLANs, it's got various connections to your internet, such as cable or ADSL or ISDN, depending on which model you buy, or I think some of them even have fibre. And some of the models have wireless access points as well. And basically, it's all of the things you want in one box, which saves you having a separate router, separate switches, and separate access points. Which, if you are building a small business, you might be able to buy one of these sorts of routers for about $700 or $800, and that might be cheaper than buying all of the different switches and stuff. The Cisco 2960 switch, if my memory serves me correct, is fairly modular. Okay, the 2940s are entry level. In other words, they're fixed configuration. You can't add things to them. But the 2960s, I believe, you can actually add things to and expand, and that's kind of useful. You also need to consider reliability, redundancy, and now redundancy is important. If your internet router blows up, you are off the air. This is probably not acceptable for a lot of businesses in 2009. Basically, work stops if you are offline. Everybody goes home or goes to the pub or finds something else to do. You probably want to make sure that you've got redundancy. Would it pay to have a spare router? Would it pay to have a spare switches or a plan to be able to get the spare switches when they're needed? Maximize your uptime. In other words, make sure that things are set up so that they're not going to crash, and you want some fault tolerances with UPSs and surge protection and all that sort of good stuff, so that people can so that you can actually survive power outages and dips and flickers and that sort of thing. Which reminds me, I've actually got to get a new battery for the UPS that's sitting on the bench in this room, because its battery failed a couple of weeks ago, and we don't have an UPS on our server equipment at the moment. Okay, plan network addressing and plan for expansion. This is important, because if you make the subnets too small, you've then got to go and re-subnet everything, and that means reconfiguring a whole stack of devices, and that's a pain. So you want to plan for perceived expansion. Even if you're using privately routable IP addresses, if you've got more than 240 hosts, you probably want to look at using either a VLSM mask that's 255.255.254.0 or similar, so that you can have 510 addresses, or look at using, say, one of the 172.16 privately routable IP blocks rather than the 192.168 addresses if you're using non-routable IP space. Hosts, routers, managed switches, they all need IP addresses. Make sure you've got enough of them in your network plan. Any questions? That's the end.
No.
Now, it goes without saying, we'd like you all to read the chapter. My lecture is just an overview of the chapter with some occasionally interesting anecdotes. It is very important that all students read their notes. I'm talking to those on and off lecture. So everybody should read chapter 3 at some point. And if anybody has any questions, there's the mailing lists and all that sort of good stuff. You can ask us there, or you can ask us on Skype, or you can email us. We do like email much better than Skype IM. But certainly ask us if you're interested in that sort of thing. Does anybody want the Discovery 2 exams up for a time?
I do.
Alrighty, I will put those up for a week once I close out of Ventrilo. And we'll also put the ITE 2 ones up as well.
Speaking of ITE 1, could I have course feedback for that activated so I can graduate as a student?
Yep, that should be fine. We'll make Jolene will make that happen in just a few moments. Yes. Okie dokie. So, I think that's all we have for this week. If anybody has any questions, queries, that sort of thing, I will write up a short explanation of that assignment. And we'll send it out to the announce list, and people can document that in a page or two and document their network, because it'll be good practice for you, and you can document your network because you're likely to know it. And what we hope you'll find is that it's actually more difficult than you thought it would be. But if you do it then and it's really easy, then good for you.
Do we need to wait on the explanation to start?
No, you don't. Of course, if there's something in the explanation when it comes out that you've missed, you may have to go back and edit your document, but, this is technology. I'm sure you'll manage.
That happened.
Alrighty, everyone. We'll see you all on Friday for ITE2, possibly, whoever's doing ITE2, and we'll be on Skype and various messengers once we can get them to behave, if you have any further questions.